Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Alessa Bali, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over 300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is, Can the International Monetary System Accommodate the Rise of China? Dr. Tabitha Benny with the Department of Political Science will introduce our speaker.
Thank you all for joining me today. It's lovely to see so many people in the audience. I'd like to first begin by thanking our co-sponsors for this event. That's the Economics Department here on campus, the Political Science Department, and of course the Hinckley Institute, who together made this talk today possible. Our speaker today is Benjamin J. Cohen, the Lewis G. Lancaster Professor of International Political Economy from the University of California at Santa Barbara. Prior to joining the faculty at UCSB, Professor Cohen taught at Princeton University and at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Dr. Cohen's research focuses on international monetary and financial relations, and he is known to many of us in the field of international political economy as one of the forefathers of our field. His newest book is entitled Advanced Introduction to International Political Economy and has just become available. Other noteworthy works include The Geography of Money, The Future of Global Currency, and International Political Economy and Intellectual History. His talk today, as they said, is Can the Monetary System Accommodate the Rise of China? I'd like to thank Professor Cohen for coming all this way and for braving the rain. We're delighted that you could join us. So without further ado, I'm looking forward to this talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tabitha, and thank you all for being here today. This is quite a crowd, and I hope that I can fulfill some expectations. I want to begin by saying that I am very grateful for this invitation to be here. It's an honor to be invited to speak with you, and I look forward to our period of question and answer after the formal presentation. Tabitha issued the invitation to me some time ago, and so I asked her naturally, what kind of an audience should I expect? And Tabitha said, this is a group that's going to be well-informed and highly enthusiastic. Well-informed and highly enthusiastic. And I thought, okay, I accept. But it also reminded me of many, many decades ago when I was an undergraduate at Columbia University. I saw a sign one time for flyers were up for a talk by a philosopher. The title of the talk was The Problem of the World. So I thought, you know, maybe I'll forget it. I don't have to come here for 4 years of education. I can just go and find out what the problem of the world is. Man stood up and he said, the problem of the world is humanity. And humanity has two problems, ignorance and apathy. And he sat down. That was it. The whole thing. I wasn't sure if I had missed the beginning or something, so I poked my elbow into the rib of the man sitting next to me, and I said, what did he say? What did he say? And the man next to me said, buddy, I don't know, and I don't give a damn. Ignorance and apathy. Okay. Okay, but it's good to know this is a group that does know, is well-informed, and is highly enthusiastic, and I look forward to our conversation. Today, what I want to do is talk about China. China in the context of the international monetary system. The question that is posed here was one that I was asked to think about as part of a collective project, which will appear as a book later this year, an edited collection, edited by two younger, but at my age, everybody's younger, two younger scholars, Jonathan Kirshner of Cornell and Eric Heliner of Waterloo University in Canada. The book is all about China in the international monetary system. It has the intriguing title, The Great Wall of Money. And I was asked to do a paper that would sort of take a more historical approach. They asked me this because I was the only one who actually lived through these experiences of all the authors in the collection. And they asked me to think about what previous experience might tell us about the issue posed by this question. We have this, the emergence of a new monetary power, a huge country called China. And China's entry into the international monetary system has clearly been disruptive. Huge trade surpluses, complaints about China's exchange rate, rapid development of the Chinese currency, the yuan or renminbi, the RMB, as an international currency. These are disruptive influences in the system, and the question is, can the system accommodate? Can the system deal with this kind of disruption, the emergence of a big new monetary power? What I did was to go back and look at some previous experiences going back to the beginning of the post-World War II period. And I looked at these previous experiences in order to see if there are any lessons that can be drawn, anything that we can learn from those previous experiences that would be relevant. The conclusion I come to is that the question is not likely to be one that can be answered with certainty, but it will depend on these two things that you see here: systemic flexibility and China's intentions. That is to say, systemic flexibility, what I mean by that is that is how flexible is the system? Does the system, the existing international monetary system, the existing arrangements that we have for the conduct of international monetary affairs, is it resistant to change? Does it put up a wall to change? Or does it have enough flexibility to bring in and accommodate the interests and priorities of a big new power like China? I'm going to suggest in this presentation that the historical analysis that I've done suggests that there is relatively little problem on this score. The international monetary system has proved to be adaptable in the episodes that I will discuss in a few moments. China's intentions, on the other hand, are more unknowable. It's simply much more difficult to know what China's true intentions are, and that is where the uncertainty comes in, as I will try to explain. Now, in thinking about the assignment that I had for this collective project, if some of you have read the paper, you know I make references to other chapters in the collection. In thinking about this, it became clear to me that there were these two big analytical issues that I had to consider. First of all, I had to consider, what do we actually mean by monetary power? How do we know when a country, or in the case of the European Monetary Union, a group of countries, becomes a big actor in international monetary affairs? What defines bigness? What defines a monetary power? I had to think about how we would actually empirically identify the characteristics of a monetary power, of a big power. The second question is, what do we mean by accommodation? There are basically three scenarios when a new big new power emerges. And that's, this would be true not just in the monetary system, but in others as well. One scenario would be that the system puts up roadblocks, tries to resist the emergence of a new power, a challenge to the established order. And that, of course, is a recipe for tension, possibly even conflict. Another possibility at the other extreme would be that the new power is co-opted. The new power is bought off in some way, absorbed into the system and bought off. And a third is what I suggest here, or will suggest. The third is where the new power is brought into governing circles, becomes a member of the club, its priorities and interests become incorporated into the principles under which the system is governed. Those are the three possibilities. Accommodation is the last. So I want to just say a few more words about each of these two analytical issues. Monetary power, what constitutes monetary power, and what constitutes accommodation. Now, if any of you have spent any time looking at the literature of international political economy, and in particular the literature of the international political economy of money and finance, you will know that there's relatively little formal theory on what we mean by international monetary power. There were some early contributions by, for example, Susan Strange in Britain and in some early work of mine, but it wasn't really until Jonathan Kirshner wrote a book in the mid-90s called Currency and Coercion that we began to think about the meaning of power in international monetary relations. Since then, there has been some work done, but there is still a great deal of debate, still a great deal of uncertainty about what we actually mean. For the purpose of this analysis, I chose to take the simplest possible definition of power and simply equate it with influence, with the ability to change behavior or outcomes. There's a whole literature that discusses other possible meanings of power, but that's the meaning of power that I start with for the purpose of this analysis. And I suggest that when thinking about power in this way, that we can talk about an actor, a state or group of states, as becoming big when they have the ability to influence systemic behavior or systemic outcomes. Their behavior has systemic consequences. But of course, that's pretty vague. So I wanted to try to put a little more flesh on the bones of that. And for that, I went back to the work of Charles Kindleberger, a well-known international economist and economic historian who was one of the pioneers of the field of international political economy in the United States. And in his early work, his most famous book was The World in Depression. And in that book, which talked about the role of hegemony in the stabilization of monetary relations, he said a big monetary power is one that serves three functions. It's a major import market. He put it a market for distressed goods, because that's language that went back to the 1930s when, in the Great Depression, you had productive capacity, but no place to sell it. Nobody wanted to buy it. Those were distressed goods. A country, he said, would be a major power, monetary power, if it was a major import market, if it was a sizable and sustained supplier of long-term capital, and going down to the bottom, and a source of crisis financing, short-term lending for crisis, for managing crises. Later on, in later work, he added these other two, a significant influence on exchange rates and a substantial influence on macroeconomic conditions. These are the five indicators of whether a country has systemic consequences. Therefore, these are the five indicators that we can say indicate whether a country has attained the status of a big monetary power. Then there's the notion of accommodation. As I suggested, accommodation can be understood as a new sharing of authority, incorporation of the new actor into councils of governance, with due deference to the interests and priorities of the newcomer. In other words, this is what distinguishes it from co-optation. Co-optation would be absorbing the newcomer, but the newcomer adapts completely to the preferences of the established order. Again, to try to put some flesh on the bones of that notion, I suggested three criteria. First of all, influence on the overall stability of the system. As I suggested, the arrival of a big new actor typically is disruptive. They run big balance payment surpluses, which means deficit pressures on others, or their currencies become widely circulating, challenging existing international currencies. and so on. The question is, does that disruption continue, or does it taper off, to use a phrase that's in the news these days with respect to monetary policy? Does it taper? Does it, it gradually, is the impact diluted and interests and priorities come into alignment? That's the first possible criterion for identifying whether accommodation has taken place. The second is whether the new actor has willingly adopted the role of a lender of last resort in time of crisis, to accept the responsibility, a systemic responsibility of providing financing at times of crisis. And the third is whether the newcomer has been brought into the inner club. And I do want to emphasize that governance of the international monetary system has always involved an inner circle, a small club of countries, as I will go into a little more. And the question is whether the newcomer is accepted into the club. Now, there's no doubt that China has, in fact, become a big monetary power. By the criteria suggested by Kindleberger, it's clear that China has become a major monetary power. It's become a dominant import market. In fact, China is the biggest trading nation in the world. It's really remarkable to think about the number of countries for whom China is now the number one trading partner. It's over 60 countries. Over 60 countries who count China as the biggest single buyer of their exports. These are, of course, mostly countries of the developing world who sell China the agricultural raw materials, the minerals, the fuels that China needs for its development. China has become one of the world's greatest creditor nations, mostly accumulated in the form of central bank reserves. The paper mentions that in mid-2013, the total of China's central bank reserves had gotten to $3.5 trillion. Okay, that's $3,500 billion worth of reserves. It's now over $4 trillion. That's an amazing figure, historically unprecedented for a country to accumulate so much in the way of reserves. But these represent net claims on the outside world. It's the evidence of China's creditor status. To some extent, China is beginning to convert some of those reserves into other forms of claims on the outside world. China created a sovereign wealth fund, which is a government entity that takes some of these reserves and invests them in various ways. They started off not very long ago, just 3 or 4 years ago, with $200 billion, and they now have a portfolio over $400 billion. They've got some smart investors in this sovereign wealth fund, the China Investment Corporation. And, of course, there's a rising level of Chinese foreign direct investment as well. But there's no question that China has become a major source of long-term finance. China has a significant effect on exchange rates now. At least that is true in the Asian region. China is part of a vast network of production chains. As you probably know, much of what China exports consists of products where the inputs come into China and then the Chinese workforce screws the things together or sews the things together or puts them together and then they're exported, which means that there are very tight trade relationships between China and other countries in the region. And for that reason, many of the countries of the region have begun to align their exchange rates with the exchange rate of the Chinese currency, the yuan. By aligning their exchange rates with the yuan, they maintain a stable price relationship with their major trading partner. And there's evidence that as many as 8 of the countries of East Asia now put more weight in managing their exchange rate, put more weight on the yuan than any other currency, including the U.S. dollar. And some people talk about this as an emerging yuan block or RMB block. And through this alignment of exchange rates, China is beginning to have an influence on macroeconomic conditions in the region as well. And finally, China is becoming a major source of crisis financing. This started with something called the Chiang Mai Initiative. Chiang Mai is a resort town in Thailand where around the year 2000, the countries of East Asia agreed that they should try to create a liquidity facility that would be available to help countries get through a financial crisis. This was as a result of the great Asian financial crisis of 1997-98 when they were forced to accept conditionality from the International Monetary Fund that they considered humiliating, and they didn't want it to happen again. And so they started this regional initiative, which later was multilateralized around 2008-2009, and is now known as Chiang Mai Initiative Multilateralization. China is a major part of the Chiang Mai Initiative and is designated as a major source of potential crisis financing, along with Japan. China has also been signing swap agreements with a number of countries, over 20 now, and these are also intended to provide liquidity to countries at times of crisis. So the question is, if China really has become such a big actor, such a major actor, such an important actor in the international monetary system, can the rise be accommodated? And that's where I look at these two issues of systemic flexibility and China's intentions. Now, on systemic flexibility, as I said, what I tried to do is to go back and look at the experience since World War II to give us some clues as to whether or not the system is likely to be sufficiently adaptable in the case of China. At the end of World War II, there was the beginning of the attempt to recreate an international monetary system. That was Bretton Woods that created the International Monetary Fund and set some rules for the development of the resurrection of an international monetary system after World War II. There was no question that at the time there was only one major monetary power and no prize for identifying that as the United States. The United States was the monetary hegemon, no doubt about it at that time. But since that time, there have been several new monetary powers that have emerged, starting with Germany in the 1960s, Japan in the 1970s. One can argue that Saudi Arabia should be included in this list as well. And then there's the Eurozone, which was expected to pose a major challenge to the dominance of the U.S. And the U.S. dollar. And when I look at examples, and I take a look at what actually happened, what's striking to me is the extent to which the system proved adaptable. I lived through all of these. I've been an academic for a long time, and I was there in the 60s. I was there in the 70s. I was there in the 80s. And I can tell you that there was great debate about each of these as they emerged, Germany, then Japan, Saudi Arabia, the Eurozone, great debates about what to do about them and whether they should be accommodated or not. But in each case, accommodation did take place successfully. They all became members of the club. Take Germany, for example. You know, it is quite remarkable, if one goes back to 1945, consider what used to be called the German economic miracle. In 1945, as you well know, Germany was destroyed and occupied by four powers. In 1949, the new Federal Republic of Germany was created out of the occupation zones of France, Britain, and the United States. The Deutschmark was created at that time. It hadn't previously existed. But through the 1950s and 60s, the German economy grew at such a rate that by the end of the 1960s, the German economy was clearly dominant in Europe, the third largest economy in the world at the time. and clearly dominant within Europe. That dominance expressed itself in a variety of ways. Other countries in Europe, for example, felt it necessary to align their exchange rates with the Deutschmark because Germany had become their major trading partner. And through those aligned exchange rates, this had major impact on macroeconomic conditions in all of the European countries that were aligned with the Deutschmark. And Germany's influence on macroeconomic conditions was not just felt in Europe, it was also felt in the United States across the Atlantic, because at this time Germany was running surpluses. The U.S., of course, was running deficits. This is 1960s now. This was before the U.S. abandoned the convertibility of the dollar into gold, closed the gold window, and the U.S. was under a lot of pressure to deal with the deficit, the counterpart to Germany's surplus, and that meant that the United States was being forced to raise its interest rates to prevent outflows of capital to Germany. As I say in the paper, there was a senior economist that I knew who said to me one time in the late 60s, he said, you know, we've come to the point where we import our cars from Japan and we import our interest rates from Germany. The influence was definitely felt. But there's no question that Germany's rise was successfully accommodated. Germany's emphasis on fighting inflation, on preventing inflation, what's called its stability culture, has been absorbed into the, as a norm in the international monetary system. Germany became a key source of crisis financing for countries in Europe. At the International Monetary Fund, Germany was brought into the governing circles. Just to pause to just explain, the International Monetary Fund that was created at Bretton Woods didn't even include Germany. Germany wasn't even a member. The way the IMF was set up, countries have quotas that are supposed to roughly correspond to their relative importance in the international monetary system, and the top five quotas entitle those five countries to an appointed seat on a board of executive directors that actually runs the International Monetary Fund. All the other members of the board of executive directors represent constituencies of, in principle, they represent constituencies, groups of countries. The first five, when the IMF was first established, Bretton Woods was when the treaty was signed, 1946 was when IMF actually started functioning, and the top five countries, the countries with the top five quotas and therefore their own appointed seat on the executive board, the top five countries were, as you might expect, the United States, Britain. Anyone care to guess who else might have been among the top five? French, she says, France, three, that's three. Anyone else? Soviet Union chose not to join, even though they had been represented at Bretton Woods. They were one of the vice chairs of the negotiation at Bretton Woods, but then when the Cold War started, they chose not to participate. No, U.S., Britain, France.
Australia.
off the radar screen. No, Italy was a defeated power at that point, too. No, it was China and India. During the war, some of you may know this from your history books, I know you don't know it from personal experience, China was the fourth of the so-called Big Four on the Allied side. But of course, Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists lost the revolution and the Civil War in 1949, at which point the China seat was frozen. The mainland was not accepted. Taiwan actually continued to occupy that seat until 1980, but it was frozen. And so over time, its quota, share of quotas went down and down. But those were the five countries. Germany in 1961, as early as 1961, was given a seat on the executive board, an appointed seat, replacing the China seat. Because that had been frozen and therefore its share had declined. In the 1960s, a so-called Group of Ten was formed to provide supplementary financing to the IMF, which was short of funds at the time. And these were the principal monetary powers in the world, and Germany was included. So it was another indicator that Germany was part of the club. And in the 1970s, when the so-called Group of Five, which then became the Group of Seven, was organized, Germany was part of that as well. So it was clear that Germany had become part of the establishment, part of the elite, part of the inner circle. And the system had successfully accommodated Germany's rise. The story with Japan is similar. Just sort of like a decade later, but similar. One big difference in the case of Japan is that Japan did not have a regional hinterland in the way that Germany did. Germany was part of this integration movement that was started with the European coal and steel community and the European common market. Its regional relationships were a natural extension of those integration efforts. Japan didn't have anything like that. In fact, Japan was greatly resented in East Asia for its wartime activities. And so Japan's rise did not take the same form as Germany's in the sense that having a direct influence on exchange rates or macroeconomic conditions. But Japan did become one of the world's largest suppliers of long-term capital, became the biggest creditor nation in the world, as the former biggest creditor nation of the world, the United States, became the world's biggest debtor nation. And Japanese currency became very popular for certain international purposes, particularly use in international bond markets. But here, too, the rise was successfully accommodated in ways similar to that of Germany. Japan agreed to voluntarily take on a role as a crisis financer. Japan got increased quotas and soon got an appointed seat on the executive board, replacing India. So now the five seats were occupied by the United States, Britain, France, Germany, and Japan. And Japan also was a founding member of the Group of Ten and the Group of Five, which became the Group of Seven. Then there's the case of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, you know, clearly is not in the same class in economic terms. It's clearly not in the same class as a Germany or a Japan. Its population was much smaller. It didn't even have its own national currency until the end of the 1950s. One of the principal currencies that circulated in the Arabian Peninsula up until the end of the 1950s was something called the Maria Theresa Thaler, going back to the days of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Throughout the Gulf region, they didn't have currencies of their own until then, until the end of the 50s. Saudi Arabia had a population then, I think, of about 15 million. But once OPEC engineered a quadrupling of oil prices in 1973, suddenly Saudi Arabia was big time. You know, it had suddenly become big time. Saudi Arabia was the biggest producer in OPEC by far, still is. The Saudis were accumulating billions, you know, I sound like Carl Sagan, billions and billions of dollars. I had friends in the banking industry who, you know, said that, you know, on any given day, you know, a wire transfer would arrive another $1 billion from Saudi Arabia. It's put on deposit. The Saudis were responsible for OPEC. They were the leading member of OPEC, and they were responsible for what in the 1970s was considered an almost unprecedented disruption of the international monetary system. Here were a small group of countries earning enormous surpluses and a lot of other countries that were dependent on oil imports suffering huge deficits and wondering where the heck am I where am I going to get the funding for this? And that led to the so-called petrodollar recycling process, whereby OPEC surpluses went into the major international banks who lent to the oil importers so they could pay to the oil exporters. I used to set it up on the blackboard or whiteboard in my classes. I used to have three circles, one with the banks, one was OPEC, and then the NOPEC, the oil importers, NOPEC. The petrodollar recycling process went on throughout the 1970s and kept the system afloat. The shock of these surpluses, and in particular Saudi Arabia's surpluses, was enormous. It acts like an excise tax in the sense that, on the one hand, higher oil prices raise prices, cause inflation, but on the other hand, they take away spending power, because income that might otherwise be spent on other things had to be spent on the increased price of oil. And so this was a major problem and caused the decade of the 1970s to be a decade of stagflation, of simultaneous high unemployment and high inflation. And these reserves also, there were many people who were worried about how these reserves might be used by the Saudis and other Arab countries to try to gain leverage on U.S. policy vis-a-vis Israel and Palestine. And it turned out, of course, that that was not a serious threat, because for the Saudis to threaten to do harm to the dollar would have been to threaten their own wealth. So it turned out not to be a serious issue. But fears were rampant, and once again, the system proved adaptable. Accommodations were made. The U.S. government accommodated the Saudis, as the slide suggests, by promising confidentiality regarding their holdings, and a special window where they could obtain obtain U.S. Government securities, and these still exist. In return for which, of course, they pledged not to disrupt the dollar. They became a major source of crisis financing, though being very cautious, the Saudis preferred to do it through the IMF. They lent money to the IMF, and then the IMF would have the risk of lending to countries in distress. That lending to the IMF, in turn, enabled the Saudis to qualify for their own seat on the board of executive directors. And, of course, they got enlarged quotas as well. Then, finally, the euro area. You know, the Maastricht Treaty was signed in 1993 and set in motion a process that by 1999 brought into existence the euro, a common currency for Europe, initially for 11 countries. Now, anybody know how many countries there are in the eurozone now? How many? No, that's the membership of the EU. 17 up until last year. Now it's 18. 18 because Latvia joined. 18 countries share the euro. And it was anticipated that the euro was going to be a very disruptive challenge to the dollar. People were confidently predicting that in a relatively short period of time, the euro would surpass the dollar. Two very well-known American economists, Menzie Chin and Jeffrey Frankel, predicted a year. They violated one of the cardinal laws of economics. One of the cardinal laws of economics is that you can predict either a development or a date, but not both in the same sentence. They actually predicted that the euro would surpass the dollar in the year 2015. Any guesses on whether that's likely to happen? Clearly not going to happen. The euro has got off to a fast start, but then sort of got into trouble, as you may well be aware, and has been suffering from severe problems the last several years, starting with Greece and extending to some of the other peripheral countries like Ireland, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Cyprus. And a lot of people were talking about the possibility of a breakup, dissolution. To be blunt, the euro has proved to be a non-contender as far as challenging the dollar is concerned. And what I've suggested here is are some of the reason. The most important has to do with the governance of the eurozone. These are sovereign states, and as sovereign states, they reserve the right to disagree. And consequently, everything that's done in the eurozone is a compromise, which is usually a second or third best compromise. So that challenge has proved to be illusory, in effect. There really was no need to accommodate the Eurozone because its principal members are already part of the inner club. They're part of the principal members, Germany, France, Italy. They're all members of the Group of Ten and the Group of Seven, the successor of the Group of Five. They're already there. There wasn't any need for further accommodation. So, bottom line, I draw three lessons from these experiences, from these four episodes, Germany, Japan, Saudi Arabia, and the Eurozone. The first is I stand by my conclusion. Some of you may disagree, but I stand by my conclusion that the system has proved sufficiently flexible, has proved or demonstrated that it has the capacity to accommodate a big new power. Secondly, I would emphasize the fact that it takes two to tango, that these new emergent powers have to make some accommodations as well. All of them did. Make some accommodations. In a sense, suggested by an early distinction that was laid out by John Ruggie, a political scientist who's now at Harvard, back in the early 1980s, when Stephen Krasner put together a collection of essays under the title International Regimes. And John Ruggie made an important distinction in his essay between two different kinds of systemic transformation or systemic change. He distinguished between what he called norm-governed change and genuine transformation. A regime was defined in that volume as a constellation of principles, norms, rules, and decision-making procedures that govern expectations in an issue area. Norm-governed change is change at the level of specific rules or specific decision-making procedures, but not at the challenging fundamental principles and norms. Genuine transformation would challenge fundamental principles and norms. None of these new contenders, Germany, Japan, Saudi Arabia, Eurozone, none of them challenged the fundamental principles and norms of the Bretton Woods system that came into existence after World War II. They all accepted that the monetary system would continue to be structured pretty much as agreed at the Bretton Woods Conference of 1944. There was no revisionism promoted by any of these four episodes, in any of these four episodes. Finally, final lesson is that geopolitics matters. It is significant, particularly when we think about China, it is significant that in all of these episodes, you were talking about countries who were military allies of the United States or military clients, in the case of Saudi Arabia, a military client of the United States. These were all countries that had tight security alliances with the United States. They were friends. It was all in the family. And has often been noted about the period of the Cold War. The countries in the Western Alliance had separate economic interests, but they rarely pushed them to the point, pushed disagreements over their respective interests to the point where those disagreements might threaten the Western Alliance confronting the Soviet Union. And none of these emergent monetary powers were prepared to do that. They were all, in the end, allies of the United States, or in the case of Saudi Arabia, a client, and reluctant to jeopardize those security relationships. So, politics trumped economics. Now, that's a little more difficult to read, I'm sorry. What about China? Well, you know, one way to think about it is people sometimes talk about when you have an emergent power in international relations, there are three possibilities. It's either going to be a rule taker, a rule maker, or a rule breaker. Those roughly correspond to the three scenarios I talked about. A rule taker would be one that gets co-opted. A rule maker is one that gets accommodated and absorbed into leadership's councils. And a rule breaker is where revisionism prevails and conflict and tension. There is no question that that China would resist co-optation. We know that. Basically, it comes down to a choice between whether China is prepared to be a status quo power or a revisionist power. That is to say, is China prepared to join the system, perhaps promote some norm-governed change, but not challenge the fundamental structure, fundamental principles and norms of the monetary system? Or is China inclined to promote something quite different from what we have now? The evidence is clearly mixed. We just don't know what the true intentions of China are in this respect. We do know that China has been very happy to be accepted into governing circles. China is very happy with its appointed seat on the Board of Executive Directors. China, the IMF has a secretary, a managing director, and then there are three or four deputy managing directors. A new managing director position was created for a Chinese national. There was already one for a Japanese, so they now have one for a Chinese national. China benefited as well after the beginning of the current global crisis when the baton was passed, the baton of leadership in the world community, in the international monetary system. Baton was passed from the group of seven to the group of 20, which had come into existence after the Asian financial crisis, but had been essentially just a talking shop until the new crisis, when it was decided that the group of seven was inadequate, no longer adequate to provide leadership for the world economy. By moving to the group of 20, effectively this was recognizing China's importance in the system. Group of 20, how many countries are there in the group of 20? 19 countries plus the European Union. So how many countries are there in the group of 20? 19 plus 28, you might think. But Britain, France, and Germany are already represented among the first 19. So it's 19 plus 28 less 4. Italy, too, 4. So it's 33 countries in the group of 20. That's what we call international monetary math. Okay. So the Chinese have been very happy. That it's given them face. It's given them prestige. They are clearly recognized as part of the group. And yet, at the same time, they give off all kinds of signals about how they would like to change the system in some very fundamental ways. Very influential was a speech that the governor of the People's Bank of China, the Central Bank of China, called People's Bank of China, gave at the International Monetary Fund in 2009, in which he said that we should no longer rely on a system, or we should no longer have to have a system that relies for international currency purposes the monies of national governments. That is to say, we should no longer rely on national currencies. Who do you suppose that was aimed at? Of course, it was aimed at the United States and the dominance of the dollar, and what they see as the abusive use of the dollar by the United States to promote its own interests. What Barry Eichengreen called his latest book, going back to to Giscard d'Estaing, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, when he was finance minister of France under Charles de Gaulle, he said that the dollar's role in the world economy gave the United States an exorbitant privilege. And this was resented by the this is resented by many, and the Chinese are saying we shouldn't rely on this any longer. We should go to a global currency based on the special drawing rights of the International Monetary Fund. So the evidence here is mixed, and we just don't know. What we do know is that there is in the Chinese culture a sense that they are natural leaders, that China is a country that should be respected as a natural leader, which would suggest that they will do everything possible to erode the influence and authority of the United States. But we just don't know. What is clear, what is very obvious, is that China is distinguished from all of the other cases that I talked about, Germany, Japan, Saudi Arabia, Eurozone, is distinguished by the fact that it is not a strategic or military ally of the United States, the still dominant monetary power. At best, China is a frenemy, if you know that expression. You know, we increasingly live in a world in which there are countries out there who are simultaneously both our friend and our enemy. Think of Afghanistan. Think of Pakistan. Frenemies. And China is at best a frenemy, a country with whom we have enormously important trade relationships, and yet at the same time, China is clearly seen as and sees itself as a strategic adversary of the United States. And that makes this case qualitatively different from any other. Now, I've spoken a little longer than I had intended, and so we won't be able to have any recording of the Q&A, which may be a good thing. But here's my conclusion. This is a real weaselly conclusion, I recognize. But it's the best I can offer you. I can offer you a firm declaration that the monetary system's degree of flexibility does not pose a problem here. If there is going to be a problem in accommodating China, it's going to have to do with China's intentions, not with whether or not the system is sufficiently adaptable or flexible. And that's an open question because China is, as Winston Churchill once said about the Soviet Union, it is a mystery inside an enigma inside of a puzzle. We just will have to wait and see. I would hesitate to make a prediction beyond my own lifetime. In my lifetime, I think China will continue to be a frenemy and will be a little schizoid in its policies. Over the longer term, revisionism may dominate, but we just don't know. What we do know is that China takes a very long view. With a very long view, you may not be familiar with the story about Henry Kissinger when he first visited China with Richard Nixon and is said to have asked Zhou Enlai, the prime minister, "So what do you think of the French Revolution?" And his answer was, "It's too soon to tell." And that's the note on which I will leave you. Thank you very much for your attention.